Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program, last night the Philadelphia Orchestra performed Diego Luzuriaga's Responsorio. David Patrick Stearns profiles the Ecuadorian-born, Philadelphia-based composer. Tom Keels explores a project at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia commemorating the 150th anniversary of the start of the American Civil War. And Susan Lewis considers the story of Mozart's life and music, as told in a new production of Amadeus at the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Philadelphia Orchestra's Inca Trails concert last night at the Kimmel Center promised some stunning visuals of the Andes and exotic sounds from composers who have lived along the one-time Inca Trail that connected what is now Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and parts of Argentina. Not so expected was the discovery of a local composer, Diego Luzuriaga, who is 55 and has been teaching in Philadelphia for the past decade. His operas, oratorios, and concertos have been performed from his native Ecuador to Tokyo to Minneapolis. So, why hadn't we heard of him here? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered that it's not because his music is quiet.
All composers have their own singular journey to artistic maturity, but Diego Luzuriaga's took side roads from the most remote villages of Ecuador to the most rarefied circles of Paris. In one way or another, his music reflects it all.
My idea was, can I compose a piece of music where there's a drumming from beginning to end? If you go to a folk festival in Ecuador, you go to the solstice festivities high up in the Andes, you hear drumming, not for 1 minute, not for 10 minutes, for 3 days. So I said, why not compose a piece on that vein? But instead of just one drum and one flute, you use a symphony orchestra.
The result was Responsorio, the piece that was introduced by the Philadelphia Orchestra following successes in Baltimore and Tanglewood, where Peruvian conductor Miguel Harth Bedoya has performed his Inca Trails concerts. But when formulating the program years back, the conductor wasn't exactly struck with the idea that some Luzuriaga might be rather nice to hear. He had to hunt around before discovering him and his music.
I started building a network of, I suppose, collaborators or future collaborators, composers, performers, literally through the internet, colleagues of mine, searching by countries, by musical periods. So doing my own research, and composers of Ecuador, various ones, and the name of Diego Luzuriaga came up, and I just wrote him an email, and he happily replied.
But not from Ecuador. He lives in suburban Philadelphia with his wife and children and teaches at Friends Central School in Wynwood. And as much as Luzuriaga enjoys going to concerts in Philadelphia, he hasn't been in touch with Network for New Music or Orchestra 2001, two groups that might be interested in performing him. Music is not his primary reason for being here.
My plan was to stay in Ecuador. Well, I was busy there. But for the health of my daughter, with special needs, and she couldn't be taken care of properly in Ecuador, so moved to here.
Luzuriaga did enter a Christmas carol contest in Minneapolis a few years ago and won. That led to a relationship with the famous Minnesota choral conductor Philip Brunel and, increasingly, a place among the Latin American composers being embraced by a larger world. The Argentinian Osvaldo Golioff is one of America's most sought-after composers. Younger ones, such as Gabriella Lena Frank, are also doing quite well. Two common characteristics that Harth Bedoya hears in Latin Americans is their ability to immerse themselves so completely into any given commission that they're constantly reinventing their methods of composition and doing so in ways that has a visceral effect on audiences.
The intellect doesn't interfere in presenting the music. In the presentation of the piece, I just find that the music is as direct as it can be.
That visceral effect appears to arise from a strong sense of cultural identity. Diego Luzuriaga spent his first 27 years getting music from sources untouched by modernity. In the remote southern Ecuadorian province where he grew up, he spoke the archaic Spanish of early colonialists. But that wasn't nearly as remote as the villages he visited with his musician buddies, armed with a reel-to-reel tape recorder to make field recordings of everything they heard. But also having heard symphony orchestras on the radio, Luzuriaga realized he needed more training than Ecuador could then provide. Thanks to some scholarships, he's lived in London, Brazil, and New York, where he studied at Columbia University and the Manhattan School of Music. More importantly, he went to L'École Normale in Paris, where he worked at the IRCOM Electronic Music Studio and was inspired by cutting-edge composers, as illustrated in this flute work titled Yerarvi.
I did the whole trip around the world. I went to France. I studied with the composers, and I was influenced by the, you know, by spectral music, Tristan Murail, Gérard Griset, which was à la mode in those years.
This was the kind of music he was hearing.
But then, little by little, I came back to my own traditions. But the music that I kept in my mind from those years. And then I think, I hope I have made a good round trip.
Yet traditions lurk behind traditions, ones that Luzuriaga can only guess at, but are reflected in responsorio.
Some people told me that some of those melodies sound Japanese. And I said, oh, I thought I was composing Ecuadorian music. If you go to the countryside in Ecuador, for example, you can hear pentatonic tunes that I bet they have been in the air for 400 or 500 years. There's this theory that 20,000 years ago, the Americas were populated by peoples from Asia, right? Yeah, there must be some connection. The melodies tend to be, in general, pentatonic.
However fascinating this confluence, Luzuriaga seems oddly lackadaisical about sharing it with the rest of the world.
I'm not that in a hurry, I suppose, to push my work, even though my friends and families say that I should. I have a web page newly redesigned by my 14-year-old son. I enjoy my basement. I compose sometimes for the pleasure of composing, but mostly because I have commissions, and that makes me happy.
One wonders what other riches might exist in those field tapes he made years ago, especially now that the world has a greater appreciation of Latin American cultures.
And you still have those tapes?
Somewhere. I don't know. At some point I worked for an institution there, and we did plenty of recordings there, and then I suppose they kept all those tapes. But the most important recording place is up here, right? The memory. The most important archive, should I say.
Perhaps only a fellow Latin American, namely conductor Harth Bedoya, could explain why Luzuriaga is happy to have music live in his head rather than preserved in more permanent ways.
For us, music is not music that we learn in conservatories or in music school. Music is a lot more part of daily life in Latin America. People make music, they sing, they dance. When the Europeans arrive in the Americas and they heard music, they heard a lot of music, and all of this is recorded in testimonials, in letters, in diaries, everybody was making music. That concept of I'm going to hear music didn't exist for a long time. Music was part of your life, whether it was for work, for harvesting, for celebration. And a lot of that is still part in our culture. So there are a lot of, you know, musicians and composers like Diego Luis Uriaga that are around, and some of them still don't write their music. Also, I've come to learn that the biggest difference in trying to differentiate either classical music or concert music or popular music, whatever it is that we want to call it, because we can't really find one good term. I think it's music that is written and music that is not written. I think that's the biggest difference in the genres of composing music.
It's a bit hard to imagine music that one lives rather than learns. But for Luis Uriaga, what he lived is maybe his greatest asset.
In Ecuador, actually, it's a common place for artists to complain that the country doesn't do anything for me. I need money. I need a scholarship. I need a free tuition. And I bet that's true, but the memories of my childhood, the melodies I heard up there in the Andes, those things were provided by my culture, by my country. And that's not a small gift. And I thank my country for that, my culture, for providing me with those things. And I'm using them all the time.
So let's hear it more now.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
2011 marks the 150th anniversary of the outbreak of the Civil War, the bloody five-year conflict that forged the United States. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores a new exhibit at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia that provides a deeply personal look at events which tore America in two.
November 30th, 1860, was less than 3 weeks after Abraham Lincoln was elected president. John Henry Brown, a Philadelphia artist, had painted a portrait of Lincoln earlier that year and found that he liked the candidate personally. But, as he wrote in his journal that day, he saw Lincoln's victory as heralding America's doom.
A number of the southern states have already called conventions for the purpose of taking into consideration their separation from the North. It is now almost certain that this glorious union will be torn asunder and some of the brightest stars obliterated from the folds of the American flag.
John Henry Brown's diary is one of a number of artifacts currently on display at the Rosenbach's The Civil War Begins exhibition, which marks the sesquicentennial of the conflict. Catherine Haas is the show's curator.
The exhibit is called The Civil War Begins, and it's an exhibit about the causes and the lead-up to the war and then the initial conflicts, Fort Sumter through the First Battle of Bull Run, First Battle of Manassas in the summer of 1861. And in fact, we start looking at issues of slavery and also some of the states' rights issues that were brewing throughout the 19th century. We look at the rise of the Republican Party in the 1850s, and then we get full force into Lincoln's election and the aftermath of that.
The exhibition includes notes from Abraham Lincoln, written in 1857, in which he tries to establish a platform for the Republican Party, then only 3 years old. There are letters from the radical abolitionist John Brown, whose abortive raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 has been called the First Battle of the Civil War. Also on display are documents describing the life and death of Colonel Elmer E. Ellsworth, the first Union officer killed in the war.
He was killed in May of 1861. He had gone into Arlington, and there had been a large, really large Confederate flag flying from the top of a tavern, and he went in, went to the roof, ripped it down, and then was coming down the stairs when the owner of the tavern came up and shot him.
Ellsworth became the first Union martyr of a war that both sides were sure would last only a few months. His body lay in state in the White House and New York City Hall before his burial in upstate New York.
It's not only an important event in and of itself, because it was one of these big galvanizing events in the early war, but also I think it's a reminder of the optimism and sort of naivete of this early war period, in which people had the time and energy to do all of this. I mean, when you fast forward to 1863, 1865, you're counting the deaths in the tens of thousands and the hundreds of thousands. And people thought that there weren't going to be that many casualties, and that this was a really singular event.
In conjunction with this exhibition, the Rosenbach has created a companion website called Today in the Civil War, which tracks the progress of the conflict through letters, diaries, and newspapers, posted 150 years to the day from when they were first written. The Rosenbach has also commissioned jazz musician and composer Dave Burrell to create an original musical work, Portraits of Civil War Heroes. Burrell, the Rosenbach's musician in residence, has drawn on its archives to paint musical portraits of four men: Colonel Ellsworth, abolitionist John Brown, Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and Union General Ulysses S. Grant. Burrell's music delves beyond the stereotypical images of these heroes. For instance, Robert E. Lee's portrait is not a military march, but a delicate, melancholy waltz. Portraits of Civil War Heroes is the fourth composition Dave Burrell has created for the Rosenbach. Having previously composed works based on modernist poet Marianne Moore, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, and the Bill of Sale for a Slave, Burrell, who performs the piece with violinist Odessa Balan, explains how his research helped to shape the Nocturne for Robert E. Lee.
We wanted to make a definite distinction between Robert E. Lee's battlefield image and emotions and his personal feelings when he wrote letters to family and superiors. The letters that I read at the museum's reading room made it very evident to me that this was a man that was torn by war and very much a human being with feelings.
By contrast, Ulysses S. Grant's portrait is a march, but it's not a swaggering victory progress. It's the plodding march of soldiers returning to camp after a lengthy battle, exhausted but happy to have survived. Burrell draws on a wide variety of musical styles from different eras and countries. For instance, his portrait of John Brown consists of two parts, life and death. The life composition, depicting Brown's children playing with freed slave children, utilizes African tribal rhythms and American nursery rhymes. The death passage draws on traditional mourning music, but also incorporates unusual rhythms and sounds.
The dirge piece, the sad piece, has the heartbeat, the human heartbeat, and the intensity of the heartbeat, and then the lack of heartbeat at all, and church bells, and those clusters, and polytonalities represent the people that came to view the hanging, that were pro-hanging, and those that were against.
America is still divided by many of the same issues that split the country 150 years ago: racial conflict, economic inequality, and personal freedom versus federal power. Visitors to the Rosenbach may gain some valuable insights into how the country addressed these issues in 1861 and how it can avoid the same mistakes in 2011.
WRTI's Tom Keels. Dave Burrell and Odessa Balan will perform the world premiere of Burrell's Portraits of Civil War Heroes at the Rosenbach on Wednesday and Saturday. The exhibition The Civil War Begins will be on display at the Rosenbach through July 17th. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, born 255 years ago this month, is still one of the world's most popular composers. A celebrated child prodigy who later struggled to support his family, his life story has engendered controversy and conjecture. Peter Schaffer's Tony Award-winning play Amadeus, turned into an Academy Award-winning film, has molded for many the image of this musical master and one of his musical contemporaries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers our fascination with Mozart and his music, as a new production of Amadeus gets set to open at the Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia.
It's difficult to overstate the contemporary appeal of Mozart or the magnitude of his contributions. In his short life of 35 years, he wrote over 600 works, excelling in nearly every type of composition, including concertos, operas, and symphonies, as well as religious and chamber music. Malcolm Black is directing the Walnut Street Theater's new production of Amadeus.
Everybody has heard some of Mozart's music in their life. So people are interested in a very great artist, one of the geniuses of all time.
Imagining how those melodies could come to you personally. It's a thrill to explore that type of mind.
Robert McClure plays the musical genius in Amadeus, a play which also explores what effect Mozart may have had on his contemporaries. What would it be like to know Mozart, especially if you were a serious musician with grand aspirations of your own? What if you were the composer Antonio Salieri? Salieri was a successful 18th century composer about 5.5 years older than Mozart. His work was performed throughout Europe. He taught Beethoven, Schubert, and Liszt. One of his operas was chosen to open La Scala in 1778. The play Amadeus, inspired by an earlier short play by Alexander Pushkin, later adapted to opera by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, speculates on the relationship between the two men, which may have mirrored a larger rivalry between German and Italian schools of music. Dan Olmsted, who plays Salieri in this production of Amadeus, says Mozart's music stirs in his character conflicting emotions.
He feels pain. He feels joy. He feels everything that a sensitive individual would feel listening to Mozart's music today. He just feels it more intensely, and he also feels like he's the only one who can appreciate it at that time.
The personal rivalry is seen through the eyes of an elderly Salieri, who claims that he not only sabotaged young Mozart's career, but in fact, murdered him. Is the story true?
This play takes place in Salieri's mind. That's the reality.
While it is based on the historical figures of Mozart and Salieri, says director Malcolm Black,
in the play, there are details of their relationship, which you might say were, if not inaccurate, exaggerated, to make the point of the play.
The two men have very different personalities. For the ultra-serious and pious Salieri, music is inextricably connected to God. Dan Olmsted, as Salieri, explains to the audience his passion.
Amici cari, I was born a pair of ears and nothing else. It is only through hearing music that I know God exists, only through writing music that I could worship. All around me, men hunger for general rights. I hungered only for particular notes.
Salieri makes a bargain with God, which Salieri feels that God doesn't keep the bargain.
Salieri wants God to make him a great composer, God's voice through music, in return for which he promises to live a virtuous and honorable life. Yet when he hears the music of Mozart, he feels both enraptured and betrayed.
Completely and utterly appreciates it to the point where it makes him collapse. And also, it's intensely painful because it's how he feels most viscerally God's rejection.
What makes it worse is that Salieri finds Mozart so distasteful as a person. Robert McClure says Mozart, celebrated as a prodigy as a child, never had a chance to grow up.
He has been so successful that he doesn't feel a need to obey behavior. I don't think he's got a sense of accountability to the rules of the period.
And so Mozart giggles, mocks the seriousness of others, and makes rude, flatulent noises.
That childlike positivity and sarcasm and wit infuriate Salieri. That God would choose such an obscene child, as he says, to bestow this gift upon. Why not someone much more virtuous and someone who's given his life back to God? Why didn't he pick that guy?
In the play, Salieri reaches a breaking point when, in an attempt to get work for her husband, Mozart's wife shows the court composer original scores, on which there appear to be no corrections.
when he takes the pen to paper, it's just transcribing what has already been completed in his mind.
Salieri does what he can to frustrate Mozart's career. The play takes place during the last decade of Mozart's life, when he broke ties with the court, a bold move which gave him artistic freedom but made him financially insecure, as one of the first freelance composers of the time, without a lot of networking skills. And yet,
he, in a sense, is realer than all of the behavior in the room. He's the man who can say what's really happening when all of them are putting on a bit of a show.
In one scene, court officials are resisting Mozart's idea to write The Marriage of Figaro, an opera set in a boudoir. They insist that opera must celebrate the goddess, not the laundress. Mozart responds with passion about the power and possibilities of opera to depict real life.
All serious operas written this century are boring. Look at us. Four gaping mouths. What a perfect quartet. I'd love to write it. Just this second of time. This now, as you are. Air Chamberlain thinking, impertinent Mozart, I must speak to the Emperor at once. An air prefect thinking, ignorant Mozart, debasing opera with his vulgarity. An air court composer thinking, German Mozart, what can he finally know about music? And Mozart himself in the middle thinking, I'm just a good fellow, why do they all disapprove of me?
Two talented musicians, both seeking perfection, tormented by their respective circumstances.
The point of the play is to show you what it's like to be a very talented man, but have to accept the fact that somebody else, who you may not respect as a person, is even more talented.
What Salieri feels, says Dan Olmsted, speaks to most artists.
That fear of mediocrity, and that you may at some point need to accept your own level, and there will very likely always be a Mozart. Just someone that you appreciate, and you say to yourself, I'm not that.
Mozart is composing his Requiem when he falls ill and dies. He is buried in a mass grave. Salieri continues as one of the most celebrated composers in Europe and outlives Mozart by over 30 years, though haunted, in the play, by the knowledge that he destroyed his rival. True, somewhat true, or even false. Amadeus is about the life of Mozart, but it is also about the idea of him. A play about genius, but also about what genius inspires in the rest of us. Appreciation, greater aspirations, or envy.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Walnut Street Theatre in Philadelphia's production of Amadeus begins previews on Tuesday, opens January 26th, and runs through March 6th. That's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.